Thank you very much. So the theme of my talk today is to speak about non-vanishing of L1F, where F is a periodic algebraic valued function. As you have seen from the talks of Professor Murthy, Shaulis, and Chester's, that when you look at special values or LSF at integers, there are two issues here. One, you want to prove it's non-zero. Once you get the number is non-zero, by using techniques from transcendence, you can prove it is transcendental. But many times, to prove a certain number is non-zero, tools from transcendence are not good enough. You have to use tools from analysis or give combinatorial identities like the one he gave yesterday, taking difference of two roots to be rational, to make sure that the number is non-zero. However, in 1973, starting from the works of Baker, Birch, and Wersing, we have a circle of ideas by which we can actually use transcendence theory to get non-vanishing results, like non-vanishing of L1F. So part of my goal is to explain to you the circle of ideas which emanates from the work of Baker, Birch, Wersing, and further developed by a series of authors like Bonsu, Murthy and Sharda, and the recent works of Ramurthy and Kumar Murthy. So that's exactly is the theme of my talk, to explain to you how we can use tools from transcendence to get non-vanishing results. Okay. So let's start. Let's take me a function. An algebraic valued function. And let's say f of n plus q is f of n for all n, q is fixed. So I'm taking an algebraic value periodic function, which is periodic with period q. And the question is, what about the number? N by n, n going from 1 to infinity. Okay. When this number makes sense, we'll come to this issue of convergence of the series. But suppose this number makes sense, you ask what about the number. As it happens in transcendence, you can show that this is actually linear form in algorithms with algebraic coefficients, because f is algebraic value. So it is either zero or transcendental by Baker's theorem. So the issue is now to prove when is this number non-zero. Okay. Now this whole idea of understanding L1F emanates from two questions by two people. One is by a question of Chawla, and another is a question of Erdos. With respect to the question of Chawla, we have a satisfactory answer. With respect to the question of Erdos, we are halfway through. Okay. Hopefully I'll explain to you both the questions and the tools which have been used to address these questions. Good. Okay, so let us start with an example. Let me take this function. F of 1 is 1. F of 2 is minus 3. F of 3 is 1. F of 4 is 1. And let me say f of n plus 4 is f of n. Periodic function with period 4. Check. Not L1F. Fn by n is actually 0. Okay, so you should be a bit careful in conjecturing or hoping what you want to get next, what you expect. I gave you an integer valued function which is periodic with period 4, and the series is actually equal to 0. Okay, so let's start with a function which we understand. Let chi equal to 1 be a Dirichlet character mod q. This is represented like this. And now let's ask the same question. We are asking about this question of epsilon chi, which is summation chi n by n. Well, Baker's theory tells you L1 chi is zero or transcendental. Dirichlet's theorem tells you L1 chi not equal to zero. Now you combine these two, get L1 chi is transcendental. Okay. First, the simplest case. So let me just ask you a curious question. Can we prove non-vanishing of L1 chi by tools from transcendence? Okay. Can I actually prove L1 chi is not equal to 0 using tools from transcendence? Yes, if chi not equal to 1 is even. Well, this is an outcome of the recent work of see that if chi is even, I can prove L1 chi is not equal to 0. What if chi is odd? Can you prove L1 chi is not equal to 0 using tools from transcendence? Very unlikely. The reason is, when chi is odd, L1 chi is actually pi times an algebraic number. So to prove that L1 chi is not equal to 0, you want to prove a certain algebraic number is non-zero. So it doesn't seem to be natural to say that you prove a certain algebraic number is non-zero using tools from transcendence. Okay. But I say it's unlikely, or doesn't appear to be natural. But you see, so when chi is odd, you cannot use, doesn't seem to be that you can use tools from transcendence. When chi is even, it seems you can use from transcendence. So it's interesting that these two different scenarios can be used for your advantage. For instance, in the work of Murthy and Murthy, this particular case is used for their advantage. In a work of Prashamurthy with Sharda, this particular work is used for their advantage when they work with the Edwards conjecture for 3 mod 4, where they essentially have to work with this setup, in which case they have to prove a certain algebraic number is non-zero, and they use the proof that it's non-zero, taking tools from cyclotomic theory. So depending on the certain case, you can actually use both these setups to your advantage. This or this. Hopefully I will explain to you. Okay. Should I write up to half or something? Okay. Yeah. So now we know that L1 chi is transcendental and chi is non-principal. So we have phi q minus 1 transcendental numbers. So the question which we ask, okay, now I have phi q minus 1 transcendental numbers. How many of them are actually new? I mean, among the set of phi q minus 1 numbers, how many new transcendental numbers we have generated? That's the question. Next question you ask. So if you put it in a more structured framework, let chi let us define, let's say, dq bar to be the q bar space generated by L1 chi not equal to 1, where chi runs through the Dirichlet characters. Look at the Q bar vector space generated by this L1 chi's, and then similarly we define dq to be the Q space generated by the same things. Okay? You have two different vector spaces. Now you ask the question, what's the dimension of these two vector spaces? Theorem of Baker, Birch, Wersing tells you that it's putting a q bar here, so you know it's a q bar vector space. Dimension of q bar of B of q bar is at least vq by 2 minus 1. Theorem of Murthy and Murthy is dimension of Q bar this is the present work. This is what it is. They give you dimension 1 over q bar. The rest are unknown objects, pq by 2 minus 1. So you have to do things. Prove all these objects which come from even are linearly independent, and you prove that the odd and even don't mix up. There are two issues here. When you put, so they have to prove both the things. You have to prove odd and even don't mix up, and you prove the evens are linearly independent. So this, hopefully I'll explain to you the tools which go into the proof of this theorem. And about the second question, about the dimension of this space, the Q space, theorem of again Baker, Birch and Wersing is dimension of Q is VQ minus 1 if Q and V of Q are coprime. If Q and VQ are coprime, this vector space has a dimension which is optimal. Okay? What about when Q and PQ are greater than 1, or it's open? Okay, so this is what this is the state of the art as regards these two spaces. Okay, so as I said, I'll try to give you a sketch of the proof of this one. Okay, so let me keep this. Okay, so now let me come back to this question, which sort of resulted in development of the circle of ideas, including the proof of this theorem. You remember the example which I gave in the beginning in which L1 is for 0, I took a function which is periodic mod 4 and which takes rational values, and I showed L1 f is equal to 0. Well, the conjecture of Chawla says that, well, this happened because you took a composite number. If you work with a prime number, this will not happen. That's the essentially is the conjecture of Chawla. Not essentially, exactly, is the conjecture of Chawla. And it's not very surprising he worked with primes, because I think he had the idea that he's going to use theorems from cyclotomic theory to prove this. And in case of a prime number, the PF cyclotomic field is easier to understand. I don't think he had, I mean, at least I don't see from his papers, he had the idea of using tools from transcendence. He thought he can solve it from simply from algebraic number theory. So he restricted it to case of prime. That's what my take is. Perhaps that's what he is. Okay, so let's start with Chawla. So let f be as before, but now I'm insisting its rational value. F of n plus p is f of n, p prime, and let's say f not identically equal to 0. Then fn by n never equals. So the example which I gave will not occur if I work with a prime modulus. So there is no restriction on f. It's not necessarily, I mean, I'm not saying that f of p is 0. It's any function f which is defined, which is periodic mod p and which is a rational value, then f of n is not equal. Summation fn by n. Okay? So, I think 4 years later, Baker, Birch, and Wersing give a complete answer to this question. And since I want to give you a detailed proof of the ideas which went through their proof, let me write down their theorem in the top. Yes, for primes you cannot do. For p, yeah, even for. Yeah, yeah, assuming the sum is convergent. Assuming the series makes sense. Minus of F2. In which case, one minus, yes, it won't be 0. Because the convergence is ensured by the sum of the values of f should be 0. Yeah. Yeah. Even those theorems also, phi q by 2 minus 1, so q should be greater than 2. Okay, so let me write down the theorem whose proof I'll try to elaborate, because okay, this is the theorem of Baker, Birch, and Wersing. I think it's 73. Let f be as before, but now I'm taking it in q bar. Chawla's conjecture is in q. Of n. Q arbitrary, not necessarily prime. Okay. Let me put one condition. Condition one is f of n is 0 when 1 is less than n of q is less than q. Okay. This is no condition as long as you restrict to the Chawla's question. I'm not putting any restriction on f of q. Okay, so as far as this particular restriction is concerned, this does not violate the hypothesis given by Chawla that f of n, there is no restriction. If q is prime, there is no restriction. And f is q bar, so contains Chawla's case. Okay, that's step one. Which was violated in the example which I gave. F of 2 was not 0. F of 2 was minus 3 or something, right? So that condition was violated. Now the second condition is that, let me look at the field generated by the numbers. That's a number field. I insist that the qth cyclotomic polynomial is irreducible over k. Now f is rational value, as in the case of Chawla, this is also not a restriction. So Chawla's case is also so these two conditions which appear to be restrictive does contain Chawla's hypothesis. Theorem is summation f of n by n is never equal to 0. So if you give me an arithmetic function which is periodic with period mod q, and you tell me that they are supported at all Copenhagen residue classes and f of q, and you tell that the field generated by the numbers on that the qth cyclotomic field is irreducible, then this number is never equal to 0. In particular, this answers this question of Chawla. So I want to give you a complete proof of this theorem using the ideas of Baker, Birch, Versing, and the ideas which were sort of developed by a paper by Sir Ramamurthy and Chawla, because I think if you combine these two papers, the proof, at least to me, appears more natural. And also, when you combine these two techniques, I need to introduce the idea of Dedekind determinant, which also is relevant when you want to answer questions about LKF when k is greater than 1. So I hope to give you a proof of this one, combining the tools from their paper and the paper with Chawla. Let's see how it goes. And hopefully I'll be able to give you proof of this one. So that's what I want to do today. Okay, I should speed up now. Okay, so how do we attack a question like this? Step one, how do we make sense when this number exists? Okay, as it has been done at least thrice in this conference, so step one is to realize that this function for real s greater than 1 is actually equal to 1 by q to the power s f of a for each beta function at a by q, a going from 1 to q, let me say sigma greater than 1. If sometimes I forget this factor, it does not make any difference, neither for non-vanishing nor for transcendence. Okay. This particular factor. Okay. I want to know when fn by n makes sense. Well, then I need to know, which is this, for sigma greater than 1. I want to put s equal to 1, so I need to know the expansion of zeta of sx around 1. Okay, so this is sigma greater than 1. I know it has a simple pole at s equal to 1. And that should be a constant term, which will depend on x. Let me call this c of x. And I have something like this. This f is a holomorphic function. Let me just plug in this data. Then LSF is summation f of a divided by s minus 1. Which one? Yeah, because it's a constant term. Around which one? Oh, yeah, this is depends on x. But this doesn't depend on x. I'm going to put s equal to 1 there, so that term will not matter. You're right, it depends on x. Okay, let me put q to the power s. Now here I will have f of a, c of a by q. Okay, and again I will have terms like this, something here. I want to put s equal to 1, so these will not contribute. Okay, so as you can see, I can put s equal to 1 provided this is 0. So, immediate. How do I make sure that thing goes up? I chose the wrong boot. Put the okay. Okay, so go fast. So observation one is, well, this makes sense. Exists if and only if is 0. Good. So let me assume this and let me throw away this term. Now what is q times L1F? This term will disappear. Is equal to f of a c of a by q. Right? Now my job is to find what's this function. And hopefully that function will tell me or help me to prove non-vanishing of L1F. Okay. Well, how do I find this function? So I need to know the constant term of fx, zeta fx. I know the constant term of the Riemann zeta function. So let me just take the difference. Yes, sorry. This identity makes sense for sigma greater than 1. This number makes sense for sigma s equal to 1. So, limit s tends to 1, 1 plus zeta x minus zeta s is actually equal to 1 by x plus 1 by n plus x minus 1 by n. So the constant term of zeta sx is constant term of zeta of s around s equal to 1 plus this number. This is gamma. So if I pull this, this goes up. Or maybe then I should use this. Okay, push this one up. Good. This I can remove. So theta of S of X is 1 by S minus 1 plus gamma plus 1 by X plus 1 by N plus X minus 1 by N plus S minus 1 times F X of S. But this function is nothing but minus of the gamma function, the logarithmic derivative of the gamma function. You recall gamma X of inverse is X e to the power gamma X 1 plus X by N e power minus X by N. If you take the logarithmic derivative, minus of gamma of X would be 1 by X is here, gamma is here, and this term contributes this term. Okay, so the constant term is actually the gamma function at X. So if I put it here, let me call that psi, minus of that. So look at this expression. This is now the minus of the psi function. So I'll just put S equal to 1. Q to the power F LSF is equal to this plus S minus 1 into something. This I now know is the minus of the gamma function. Let me put everything together to get this expression. That this is, let me put a minus here. Till now I have not used anything about the nature of F, just analysis. Okay. So I have managed to write L1F when it exists as a rational linear combination of the gamma values. But as you heard from Professor Wallsmith talk, even for the gamma values, we don't understand the behavior at rational points. So, and now I have a gamma function, which seemingly appears as complicated, if not less or more than the for the gamma function. So to prove L1F is not equal to 0 by proving something about the gamma function does not seem to be working. So this itself is an unknown function. Okay, but let's keep this. Okay, so this is the first idea. Now the second idea is, let's do some Fourier analysis. Now L1F is also Fn by N. Since F is periodic, let me define F hat of N to be 1 by Q F of A zeta Q of minus An. My inverse Fourier, so this will be equal to, so F of N would be F hat of A zeta Q of plus An. So you get an important advantage here, is that you can now go from A equal to 1 to Q minus 1, because F hat of Q is 0. F hat of Q is, this is relevant. F hat of Q is essentially A 1 by Q, which is 0. That is important for us. So while here I go up to Q, here I go up to Q minus 1. What is my loss? I had rational combination of unknown objects. Now I have algebraic coefficients. In fact, if F were vanishing at, say, if A vanishing at co-prime classes, this no longer holds for F hat A. F hat A does not share the properties of F of A. So this is now, this I cannot control. But let's just put it here and see what happens. F hat of A zeta Q of A n by n, take the A out. Yeah. I'm going too slow. Okay. So take the A out, you have zeta Q A n by n. which is minus of log of fine. So now I had rational linear combination of diagram of functions. Now I have algebraic linear combination of log of algebraic numbers. So my loss in not being able to control the nature of the coefficients is compensated by having numbers which we understand, log of algebraic numbers. It would have been true if these numbers were linearly independent over Q. The Baker's theorem would have proved it. But in general, they are not. So you will not be able to prove that this is not equal to zero. What you can prove is either zero or transcendent. So this itself does not prove L1F is equal to zero. So what I plan to tell you is that I can use this identity together with this identity to prove L1F is not equal to zero, using one fact, which is L1 chi is not equal to zero, where chi is a non-principal character, which, as I said, for even case you can do it by transcendence, for odd case you cannot. Okay? So let's see. So this is the first idea. Write it like this. This is the second idea. Write it like this. Now I'm going to do a little bit. I have not used any hypothesis on F till now. Except summation FA is zero for convergence issue. Okay, so now summation F of A is zero. Okay, so F of Q is actually minus of F of A. So let me put it here to get A equal to Q minus 1 psi of A by Q plus gamma, because psi of 1 is minus gamma. Okay, you'll see in a moment why this works to my advantage. Again, I have not used coplanarity yet. So let's keep this identity. So if you give me a function, L function which is periodic, and if you have an expression like this, is exactly equal to L1F. Okay? If F were a character, this is L1 chi. Okay? So let's keep this identity and keep this identity together. Now the third idea is Galois action. Linear forms. Okay, this is again. Okay, keep it like this. See, here you have a linear forming logarithm. Now, let us assume all the hypotheses on F for the Baker-Birch, and assume that L1F is zero. So what is given? That for 1 less than equal to A of Q less than Q, F of A is 0. And the QH cyclotomic field is irreducible over the field generated by the values of F. So I'm not writing this condition. That's condition 1 and condition 2. Okay. And I'm assuming L1F is 0. So this F hat of A to 0. Okay. Now, this is again a very nice idea of Baker-Birch inversing. If you give me a linear forming algorithm, okay, it's either 0 or transcendental. Okay, suppose it's 0. and these are algebraic numbers. Take any element of the Galois group of Q bar over Q. Pretend that these numbers don't exist, just apply sigma to this identity. We can only apply sigma to these objects, so just apply. Now you have another linear form in logarithm. Okay? Again, it's zero or transcendental. Theorem is zero. This is theorem Baker-Burchell. Okay? If you have a linear form in logarithm which adds up to zero, if you take any element of the Galois group of Q bar over Q and you construct this new linear form in logarithm, this is still zero. Idea? Just look at a maximum linear independent subset, reduce it to a relation over Q, apply Galois, Galois will not disturb Q, apply Galois, then come back. This idea. To going from Q bar to Q, you need Baker's theorem. Take a relation among Q bar, reduce it to a relation over Q, apply Galois, Galois will not disturb the Q, and then come back. So this is the idea of proving this theorem. So let me just assume it. Okay. So now I have a similar case here. I have a linear form in logarithm which goes to zero. If I act by any element of Galois, sigma of f hat f log of 1 minus zeta k will again be zero. Okay, this is okay. But now I think we remember the statements. Okay, so what are the Galois elements which are the target elements? Well, I'm going to act this identity by these elements. The Galois elements in the Galois group of the cyclotomic field. This is beta q. Okay. Now let's just quickly see what does it do to f hat fa. So if I act, I'll get sigma c of f hat of a is again zero. A moment's reflection will tell you that sigma c of f hat of a is actually f hat of ac. And this is exactly the place where you use that the coefficients f of a's remain undisturbed by action of the Galois group of q zeta q. Because f hat of a is f of zeta q to the power something, I'm going to act sigma of c on that. It won't disturb the f part. It will only change the zeta q to the power minus ab. It will change it to zeta q to the power minus abc, which is exactly equal to f hat of ac. Sigma c of f hat of a is f of b zeta q of minus abc. It will not disturb f of b. Okay. So disjointness. So let me write this equation as this now. So now I have phi q equations. For every c co prime to q, I have an equation like this. Now this is equal to this. This expression now, this particular expression, which I am writing it as f hat of ac log of 1 minus zeta q to the power a equal to 1 to q minus 1 will be equal to, if you use this identity, f of ac. Now I come back here. which is again 0 for all CQ. This identity, this function has changed. It is no longer f. It is f of n is f of nc. Okay, so this is not L1f, this is some other L1 of fc. But still it is 0, because this is 0. Okay, till now everything is fine. Now I have pq equations, and if I treat fa's as variables, I have q minus 1 variables. But if you remember, I am assuming that whenever aq is less than 1 and less than q, the fa's are 0. So I can put on one more condition. So this is q minus 1, aq is co-prime. No change. Now I have pq equations and pq variables. So I have I make a change of variables here, and I get this following pq equations in pq variables. F of A, psi of AC inverse of Q plus gamma is always 0 for all CQ equal to 1 AQ 1. I am done if I prove this matrix is invertible. Look at the matrix M, which is psi of AC inverse of Q plus gamma A and C running over this group. That's called a Dedekind determinant. I have a function. Let me just quickly define it. So you agree if I prove M is invertible, I am done. All these FAs would be 0. And since F of Q is the summation of the other ones, F of Q would be 0. Everything is 0. That's what I wanted to prove. Baker, Birch and Wersing did not use this idea of Dedekind determinant, but I think this makes it a bit more clean. So they work with each character one at a time. I'm not saying it's simpler, but just makes it more structured. So what's Dedekind determinant? So Lang calls it Dedekind Frobenius determinant. So let me just Dedekind Frobenius. So take any G finite abelian group. Take any function, complex product function, and look at this matrix. Very similar to something you have here. This is the group here. Theorem is determinant of MF is the product of all characters on G hat, sum of F of A, chi of A, A running over the elements of the group. In other words, these are the eigenvalues of this matrix. If you want to prove it, if I give you this form, the simplest way to prove it is that define an operator so that T of chi is this times chi. Just define it that way. Make sure these are already eigenvalues of an operator with eigenvectors chi. If somehow you can prove that matrix has a representation like this, you are done. Choose another basis, which FB of A is 1 if B is equal to A, otherwise not. And realize that this particular operator in that matrix has this form. Okay, but that's the proof. Define your operator to be on the space of all functions. It's sufficient to define on characters because they form a basis. Define T of chi is F of A, chi of A, A equal to 1 to A into chi, and work it out. Okay, so that's the proof. Now let's see what happens here. Here I have a group which is Z mod QZ star, and the function is, in this case, my group is Z mod QZ star to C, and I am defining F of C to be psi of C by Q plus gamma. then you have this matrix. So the determinant of M is product of all Dirichlet characters. Summation psi of A by Q plus gamma into F of A. Chi of A. Right? Which is very similar to that object. F of A, psi of A by Q plus gamma, where F is now replaced by chi. So if chi is non-trivial, this is essentially Q times L1 chi. So let me just write down. Which is equal to, if chi is non-trivial, this is essentially Q times or 1 by Q maybe. Exactly, yeah. L1 chi. Now if chi is trivial, I get psi of A by Q plus gamma AQ equal to 1, this number, right? This is psi of minus of psi of 1, and psi is a strictly increasing function. Each of these numbers are negative, so their sum is negative. This is not equal to 0, this is not equal to 0, determinant is non-zero. That's the proof. So this one comes from the trivial character, this one comes from non-trivial character, but as I say, I need L1 chi not equal to 0. And hence, determinant of M is not equal to 0, and hence all these essays have to be 0. That gives the proof. Okay? So this is the circle of ideas which goes through. So now, let me go back to the recent work and I tell you what are the new two ideas which came up in that paper. Fine. So this is how you prove Baker, Birch and Wirth. Okay, now let me go back to the theorem which I said was proved recently, is that dimension of dq of bar or q bar is phi q by 2. Right? Okay. What are the two tools? So as he pointed out, I need to prove two things. L1 chi and chi runs through even characters are linearly independent over Q bar. Chi runs through even characters not equal to 1. I need to prove this. And I need to prove this, that the contribution from the odd part and the contribution of even part are disjoint. So, and L1 chi, when chi is odd, is not, I mean, is disjoint. From the space of even characters. Right? If I prove these two, I'm done. The odd parts give me dimension 1 because they are all pi times an algebraic number. These are pq by 2 minus 1. If I prove these two, I have proved this theorem. So, I can just tell you what are the main ideas of these two. Maybe I will prove this one because it uses an important fact which Shaoli used, that I is not a real number. So. Let me very quickly give you what works here. What works here is the realization of them that when chi is even, L1 chi is actually chi is essentially an algebraic multiple of chi bar of A, log of zeta of A, where zeta of A are real and multiplicatively independent. Both I would need. You remember when I said in the beginning you wrote L1F as log of 1 minus zeta q to the power A. The problem was you did not know whether they are linearly independent over q or not. But when his chi is odd, but they realize that you can write L1 chi as a non-zero algebraic multiple of numbers of these types, but these are multiplicatively independent, so their logs are linearly independent, and they are real, which I'm not using here. Okay, so this is step one. Hence, these are called
logs.
Yes, these units which you come up here are exactly the units of Ramchandra. Okay, so in particular, it proves it's non-zero. L1 chi is non-zero, and when you take a linear combination of these guys, you can treat even characters as characters in the group Z mod Q just are quotient by plus minus 1. So by linear independence of characters, you can prove that these are linearly independent. Okay, that's the first step. Realize that L1 chi is a algebraic linear combination of log of real positive. Important. Real positive multiplicatively independent algebraic numbers and the even characters form a group. Once you put this thing together, you get this. Okay? So let me quickly give you what works here, because that's to use Baker's theory again. For part two, the essential idea is write f as f even plus f odd. Every function you can write as an even function and an odd function. Theorem is L1 f is 0 if and only if L1 of even is equal to 0 is L1 of odd. L1 of a is 0 if and only if the contribution both from the even part as well as odd part is 0. So, do I have 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have.
No, you have 2 minutes.
Good. So let me tell you what's the main point here. Okay? Main point is the following. If you do the calculation correctly, L1 of f of even is algebraic. It looks like lambda of a log of alpha of a, where alpha f of a is strictly positive. L1 of odd is I pi times an algebraic number, which is, by the way, is a times log of minus 1. Okay, so if this is equal to this and this is non-zero, assume, replace this, I can assume alpha is to be independent without loss of generality. So if lambda of a log of alpha a is I pi times a, where lambda a is in Q bar, A is in Q bar, and if I assume these are linearly independent over Q bar, I can replace this identity by an identity over rationals. These are strictly positive numbers. This is a real number. This is a complex number. And hence, they cannot match. So the contribution from the even part as well as odd part have to be zero. That's the idea, to realize that when you have log of minus 1 on the one side and you have log of positive reals on the other side, the only way they can be zero if contribution from both sides is zero. So once you put these two together, you get the theorem of this. Let's stop here.